Orifice. For just a second, as he trod the line between unconsciousness and waking, Anakin Skywalker relived his 13th birthday. As that had been approximately the worst day of his life, this was not a pleasant experience, but he supposed, as he lurched upward through layers of dreamlike memory to something resembling consciousness, it beat waking up dead. Even once he was fully awake, and knew he wasn't really reliving that day, the sensations were very similar. He hurt all over, worse in some places than others, and the main source was down at the end of his right arm. Or, well, midway down the arm, if he took proprioception's word for it. But he knew from experience that there wasn't going to be anything beyond that point anymore. Last time, that had been because the arm had been cut off by the man who killed Master Sifo Dyas. This time, it was because Anakin had blown up his own cyber limb by setting off its built-in concussion blaster while it was in direct contact with another surface, to wit, Shuten Doji's breastplate. On the plus side, the look on the son of a bitch's face as he went out the side window of the Central Hall Gallery had been worth it. Well, mostly worth it. Anakin sat slowly up, suppressing the kind of groan that would give rise to haunted house rumors under the right circumstances, and looked around. He didn't recognize the room at first. Dark, timbered, and high-ceilinged, it might have been almost any room on campus. Only on a second look did he notice the bookshelves, the low table at the far end covered in alchemy equipment, the armillary sphere, a wizard's study. The wizard's study. "Ah, you're awake at last," said Soji Mikage with a faint smile. "You've had a busy day, young man. Miss Tarrant tells me you did a gallant but foolish thing." "Yeah, well, that's me," Anakin said, swinging his legs off the long table on which he'd awakened. "Surprised they didn't finish me off." "They might have, if Miss Tarrant hadn't come and fetched me," said Mikage. "Oh, don't get up," he added as Anakin braced himself with his one remaining hand and made ready to hop down from the table. "You're in no condition, and besides, I haven't finished my work yet." Anakin frowned at him. "What work? I have to..." Mikage shook his head and gestured. Some force Anakin couldn't see or identify pushed him back down onto the table, stretching him out like the Frankenstein monster on his slab. Anakin gritted his teeth and tried to rise, but whatever this force was, it wasn't the force, and his own connection to Sam didn't seem to be availing him much against it. Or maybe he just couldn't concentrate because what was left of his arm hurt so much. Stupid cybernetic interface. A proper one would have had a feedback cutout for such a catastrophic system failure, but then a proper one would also have cost more than 5 credits 95. "I don't know what you're planning to do," he growled, "but I can tell you this, it'll be a big mistake." "Not at all," said Mikage. "I'm doing you a favor. Now do be quiet and let me work. These operations are quite delicate. In fact, it would have been better if you hadn't regained consciousness just yet. One does find all the screaming a bit distracting." "Screaming? What scree—" Anakin asked, and then he found out. 0623 hours GST, Babylon 6. Breakfast in Medlab was a lot more lively than Konami had been expecting. With the continued presence of Mizuki and Sosuke, and the addition of her friends Maya Mukai and Shiori Kudo, and the updates of the situation on Tau Ceti from Network 23, the whole thing had the feeling of an oddly reversed slumber party. Although Sosuke's presence could have theoretically caused some hesitancy, by now all four girls had gotten used to his presence and tuned him out unless he spoke up. Live coverage was now being beamed from at least three sources on the planet's surface. Truss was dirtside, as was Big Time's Nanami Jinai, and one of the IPO irregulars accompanying the task force had camera assets of his own, which made sense, given he was a filmmaker by profession. Unlike the two network newscasters, Chad Collier wasn't talking, just letting his camera track along with what he was doing, which appeared to be helping several of the black armored women who had accompanied the strike force recapture a hydroelectric dam from Earth Force. An editor somewhere between the reporters and the viewers, Misuki, who was something of a fan, was betting it was Truss's Net23 controller-producer, Murph Rosenberg, was skillfully weaving the three streams together with occasional updates from orbital cameras, creating a fast-moving but coherent stream of coverage that switched from Truss and Hanami's straightforward reportage to Collier's cinema verite interludes and snatches of the ongoing battle in space, to give the billions watching the incident unfold around the galaxy a surprisingly coherent picture of what was happening. Which, as far as Konami could tell, was that the good guys were kicking ass and taking names, but they had an awful lot of ass to kick before they could declare job done. At this hour, Truss was at Commodore Tenjo's command post, preparing to go in with the Commodore's main force as they commenced their assault on the city's government center. Nanami was at the headquarters of the local police, covering Tau City's finest as, newly sprung from their own jail by a detachment of IPO tactical operators and irregulars, they geared up to strike the Earth Force position's flank in concert with the main assault. Collier and the group he was accompanying at the dam had run into pretty stiff opposition, resulting in part of the city being blacked out, but they'd won through in the end and were now getting set to form still a third prong of the offensive. The mainstream switched back to Truss as the main assault on Government Center began. The action was spread out over a large, rubble-strewn area, and Truss's camera could pick out only so much of the action at once, but the overall impression was of a furious, fast-moving engagement in which the Earth Force defenders were wrong-footed and falling back almost from the start. The IPO task force was an ad hoc arrangement, and its people were equipped with such wildly different gear that they seemed almost like a ragtag mob in comparison, but under the surface they had the Gropos completely outclassed. Afterward, Kaname and her friends would only have clear recall of individual moments, like snapshots of the battle, as the lens moved from point to point and picked out fleeting instants amid the melee. An ODST from the Illustrious going down to PPG fire. One of those people who looked like high-tech Roman legionaries bull-rushing a Gropo with his brightly painted full-body shield. A big, red-bearded man in ornate scale armor, easily holding his own against a dozen or more troopers with nothing more than what appeared to be an iron mallet. Utina and a black-armored woman with a red stripe down her right gauntlet, back-to-back in the middle of the plaza, Utina fending off a shock-stick-armed trooper with her sword, while the woman in black armor blazed away at something off-screen with a curiously antique marksman rifle. The view blurred, the camera's wielder swinging it to train on another section of the battlefield, and suddenly a petite blonde figure in a slightly tattered DSM uniform lunged into view. With one hand, she used a katana to parry the shotgun of a helmetless riot cop who had apparently chosen to side with the invaders. Unhesitating, as the shotgun discharged harmlessly into the ground to one side, she hauled off and slugged the man in the face with the other fist, flattening him to the ground.
"Oh my God, is that Lindsay?"
Misuki blurted.
"Damn, she's got a hell of a left cross," Maya observed, impressed. "That guy's going to be eating through a straw for a while."
"Apparently my initial impression of her tactical value was in error," said Sosuke mildly.
"That was a cop! She punched out a cop!"
Shiori cried. Maya shrugged. "In fairness, he was trying to shoot her."
"My God, they could close the whole school for this," said Shiori.
With a sigh, Kaname told her,
"Will you relax? They're deputized IPO officers engaged in the lawful restoration of the Setian government. Nobody's going to close the school."
Maya turned and gave her a look she had a hard time reading.
"What?"
"Think about what you just said," Maya said.
"I mean, I realize you're from an old line military family, Kaname, but..."
She gestured to the screen.
Kids from our school in the middle of that crap? That's crazy. They're crazy.
She shook her head. I'm as impressed as the next girl at how they're handling it, but what are they even doing there? I mean, minors in a war zone?
Yeah, when their parents had to sign that thing that said, yeah, we know this club does dangerous stuff, it's okay, I bet they weren't really thinking of this, Misuki agreed.
That's not, Kaname said, but then ground to a halt as she realized there was really nothing she could reasonably say to that.
Not having anything a person could reasonably say had never stopped Sosuke Sagara, though, and now he piped up from his corner, saying calmly,
They're very effectively using the expectations you just summarized, Ms. Mukai, to their own tactical advantage. Expectations which are also held by the Earth Force troopers and rogue law enforcement officers constituting the OPFOR. It's very well done.
Maya blinked at him.
Sorry, what?
In a conventional force scenario, Sosuke explained, properly trained and equipped youth or even child combatants can be an amazingly effective asset for the side willing to deploy them. Maya looked sidelong at him, then turned back to the TV, mumbling,
Okay, that just seriously spiked my creeped-out-o-meter.
Leaning toward Kaname, she said in an even lower voice,
Are you seriously hitting that?
No, shut up, Kaname replied, her face going red.
Shut up, look!
Misuki interrupted, pointing. Leaning toward the set, she cried as if the images could hear her,
Lindsay, look out!
After hitting several other hotspots in the ongoing fight outside Government House, the camera had swung suddenly back to Lindsay Willows. She was facing the wrong way, looking off to the right at something out of view, as a trio of Earth Force troopers appeared from the left, one with his sidearm drawn, the others leveling their rifles. Lindsay apparently heard them. The one with the pistol seemed to be shouting, though he couldn't be heard on the TV, and whirled, but too slowly. Kaname drew a sharp breath as all four girls steeled themselves, expecting the next second to contain something terrible happening to their friend. Instead, a man in that segmented Roman-style armor appeared as if out of nowhere. He had a red cape, wore no helmet, and carried no shield, instead wielding one of those short swords in one hand and a blaster pistol in the other. One of the soldiers learned of his arrival by being struck down where he stood. The other two pivoted, but the Roman shot one and deflected the other's snapshot with his sword, then cut him down as well. There was no hesitation in him, but Kaname wasn't sure how she could tell this exactly, but she felt sure of it. No malice, either. She'd seen the same in others on this chaotic battlefield, but it especially stood out in this one. The weight of his experience, the firmness of his decision, the willingness to do whatever was necessary, absent both joy and sorrow. It was, she realized with a shock, exactly the same thing she'd seen in Sosuke on Brown 21. That shock, however, paled in comparison to the one she got when he finished his grim work and turned to Lindsay. As he did, his face came fully into view, lips silently forming the words, Are you all right?
Oh my, Maya blurted as his profile came into clear focus. Isn't that Rory Williams?
And it was. Kaname looked back over her shoulder at Sosuke, whose gaze was fixed intently on the screen. He looked to her, met her eyes, and nodded gravely. I told you. The camera moved away, following the battle as it swept into Government Center. Neither Lindsay nor Rory appeared again. Within another half hour, the fighting was over, and the analysis began. 0944 hours GST, 8:44 a.m. Tau City time. Operation Trident, mission elapsed time, 0744. Tau City 4. Utena Tenjo stood on the balcony of the presidential residence, Government House, looking out over Tau City, and reflected on the satisfaction of a well-done morning's work. One of these days,
she remarked wryly to President Callan. I'm going to have to see what this town looks like when it's not on fire. Callan, who looked even more exhausted than Utina felt, laughed wanly. I'll do my best to arrange that, he said. Then, sobering, he added, kidding aside, it would have been a lot worse if you hadn't come back. Thank you. Hey, a deal's a deal, Utina replied with a tired grin. Tell you what, if you really want to thank me, find me some place where I can hole up for a few hours, go over these casualty reports, gesturing to a stack of data pads on a table nearby, and maybe get some sleep while we wait for the other shoe. You still think there'll be one? Callan asked as she gathered up the data pads. With Earthdome, there always is, Utina observed. Said Callan glumly. Well, our own defenses are on alert this time. Between that and your forces remaining on station for the present, we should at least be better prepared if a counterattack does come. In the meantime, I imagine there isn't anywhere on this planet where you wouldn't be welcome to grab a nap, he added with a smile. But my personal quarters on the third floor would probably be best. They're within easy reach of the situation room. Utina gave him a skeptical look as they went back inside his office. Don't you want to use them yourself? No offense, but you look beat. Callan gave another dry laugh. I am. But for the moment, I'm needed here. After the last 24 hours, my people need to know that I'm in my office and on the job. Utina nodded. All right, then. If you're sure I won't be putting you out, I'll take you up on that. They made arrangements from the phone on Callan's desk for all comms relating to Task Force Trident to be routed to the third-floor situation room, and then she took her leave of the president and made her way down to that level. As she went, navigating the unfamiliar corridors of the palace carefully, she reached out with her lens and made contact with various other members of her ad hoc command staff, making certain that her mismatched forces were disposed to best effect and ready for whatever might develop in the next few hours. The last contact she made was with Corwin, whom she'd barely seen since the operation began. If all was going according to plan, he'd be back at the Tau City spaceport now, with the Valkyrie and most of the ODSTs from Illustrious, consolidating the reopening of the planet's principal external supply line. Corwin. What's up? Invest in Nishnoyas, Corwin replied, except I can't find Nanami anywhere. Nanami from Big Time TV? Pretty sure she and Truss are still at the broadcast thing they set up across the way there. Wrong Nanami. I'm talking about Nanami from Sephiro Nanami. Utina took a moment to digest that, then said, Nanami Kiryu? She's here? Oh, yeah, I guess I didn't get a chance to mention that earlier, huh, said Corwin. It's kind of a long story. Anyway, she was here, but she seems to have wandered off. Which would, frankly, be fine with me, except I'm not sure I like the idea of her running around unsupervised. His mental shrug came clearly to her through the link. There were a number of follow-up questions Utina could have put to him, but in the end all she said was, Well, she'll turn up. She always does. Is that a hint of jealousy, I sense? Corwin asked impishly. That seems likely, Utina replied. Anyway, I'm going to crawl under a rock for a few hours and try to get some paperwork done and some sleep, probably in that order. Ping me if anything comes up. Roger that. When I get done here, I'm going down to TCDF HQ to see if I can help their quartermasters get the rest of their destroyed forces operational. The Earth Force goons tried to spike most of their heavies' reactors, but I think they did a pretty half-assed job. With Eve and Wally's help, me and Leneth and Tally can probably get them back on their feet in a few hours. We've been married for 20 hours, kind of. And you're already having geek-out time with old girlfriends, Utina teased. It's disgraceful. Corwin chuckled. You could come help if you didn't have 11 million other things to do.
Go on with you, then. As you so diplomatically point out, I have work to do.
Best get to it, then. Hey.
Yeah?
Love you madly.
Utna smiled.
Get to work, you pirate. I love you, too.
Elsewhere in the city, the rest of the Task Force Trident ground contingent were either digging in to face a potential counterattack, or, having done what they felt they could to prepare for same, finding their own ways and places to shed the tension of battle and get some much-needed rest. The Irregulars, in particular, of whom there were many, had completed what preparations they felt they could do in fairly short order. The Duelist contingent had established their command post just downstairs, in the lobby of Government House, with camp beds and other temporary furnishings borrowed from the Tau City Constabulary. By this point, most of them were either out or asleep, apart from Mitsuru Tsuwabuki, who was sitting upright, cross-legged, on his cot, and seemed to be in some sort of meditative trance, and Peregrine Took, who sat at what had been the reception desk, polishing a burn scar off the blade of her sword. Anaximandra Drax returned to the lobby from the ladies' room down the hall and saw her Vetir friend still awake. Crossing to the desk, she pulled across a spare chair and sat down next to Perry.
"Hello," Perry said cheerfully, carrying on with her work.
"And how's herself, then?"
"I'm well, thank you,"
Anaximandra replied.
She paused for a moment, considering ways of introducing the topic that was on her mind, then decided to just come out with it. Perry was exactly the sort of person who would respond to a blunt inquiry. It matched up well with her own personality.
"Peregrine, was today typical of an Order of the Rose outing?" she asked.
"I thought we agreed nae to be so formal," said Perry with a smile.
"Sorry. Perry, then, the question remains."
"Better. Well, Anna, I wouldna say it's exactly typical. I mean, 'tis nae as if we go to war on a regular basis, but..."
Perry shrugged.
"If the bell rings, we answer it. Part of the job."
She eyed her Svart Elven roommate speculatively.
"Does that surprise you?"
"A little," Anna admitted. "In my relatively short time at Tenjo Academy, I had formed the impression that the Order was simply a school club. An unusually influential one, to be sure, but... well, to be suddenly involved in an armed incident in Midgard was a bit of a surprise."
Perry chuckled. "Surprised or not, you handled yourself well. You could have just set the whole mess out. Nobody expected you to get involved."
"After all you and Mitsuru and the others have done for me, I could hardly stand idle or hide," Anna replied, a trifle stuffily. "I do have my pride."
"Fair enough."
Perry finished polishing her blade, examined it with a critical eye, then nodded with satisfaction and put it away.
"No. I don't know about you, but I'm starving. The rest of this lot can sleep away the morning if they like, but this Shire girl is going to get some second breakfast in her."
She hopped down from her seat and declared,
"Let's you and me see if the president's kitchen staff is all it ought to be."
Across town at the spaceport, Perry's second cousin, twice removed, Aaron, of the Long Cleave Stonefists, was not particularly preoccupied with second breakfast. That was more of a Westfarthing practice anyway, and besides, Aaron was unusually indifferent to cuisine for a Shireling. She could feast with the best of them when the occasion called for it, she was a Valkyrie after all, but when it didn't, she was just as happy to cram down some field rations and call it a day lunchwise. Just now, she was much too sleepy to consider eating anyway. When the fighting ended, one-fourth of the Corps of Valkyrie on the scene,
the ones who had been on duty for the graveyard shift before the intended wedding, and thus had been on the move for nearly 36 hours at that point, were dismissed to rooms in the spaceport's attached hotel, with orders to get some rest and report to relieve the midwatch at 1600. Erin had been among them, but she was too wired from the battle to get to sleep immediately. She'd needed to burn off some of that nervous energy first. The solution she'd found to this problem had worked spectacularly well, if she did say so herself.
"I thought you said your people didn't appreciate being manhandled," said Xander Cage, amused.
"Well," Erin mumbled, resting an arm over his muscle-ridged midsection as she went to sleep. "In practice, that depends on the man doing the handling."
Cage put a hand fondly on her shoulder, chuckling seismically, and then reached with his free hand to set the alarm. The 66th Einherjar's scout century had wasted little time in clearing the area immediately adjacent to Government House of debris, then erecting a field camp of such elaborate sophistication that an untrained observer might have thought they were planning to stay permanently. Past masters of the art, the entire Legion could make or break camp in little more than an hour if need be. Not just a cluster of tents to sleep in out of the rain, either, but commissary, infirmary dispensary, quartermaster's stores, in short, everything the Legion would need to operate for a day, a week, a year. A single century's encampment was a bit simpler than that, but not much. And it was a fully equipped, if small, quartermaster tent which Rory Williams entered 3 hours after the battle. He was back in the school uniform he'd been wearing for the wedding, though he'd stuffed the tie in his top pocket rather than put it back on. Stepping inside, he put the collapsed suit of Lorica Electromagnetica he'd been wearing for the fighting on the counter, then placed a neatly folded red Centurion's cloak and holstered blaster pistol atop it.
"Awe, Praetor," said the quartermaster, saluting him with fist to chest.
Hi, Rory said, looking faintly embarrassed. "I'm just returning this."
The quartermaster frowned. "Why?" he asked. "It's yours."
No, Rory told him. "I just borrowed it for the..."
"Nonsense," said another voice from the back of the tent, and Praefecta Flavia Satori emerged from the stacks of equipment cases and provisions behind the quartermaster. She'd shed her armor, but still wore the gold-trimmed red tunic of her office, and with hands on hips she regarded him severely for a moment, then said, "I must insist you keep it, Centurion. I won't have it said that the Pugnus Mortis repossessed equipment from a veteran of the great 20th Valeria Victrix."
Rory looked faintly startled. Flavia held the severe look on him for a moment longer, then smiled and told him, "Griffonifer Eudoxia recognized you. She knew you in Britannia of old. Roranicus of Carinium, sentinel of the Pandorica, the ever-faithful. She's told us your tale 1,000 times, around 1,000 campfires.
The prefect's smile became a little wry as she added, "To be honest, I thought she was having us on."
"Probably best if you go back to that," Rory said after a few moments' musing.
"After your performance in the field this day, it matters little to most of us who you are," the quartermaster spoke up. "It would break this old soldier's heart to take back the arms of such a man. Please."
Rory looked at Flavia. She shrugged, still smiling.
"Quintus is a sentimentalist," she said.
"Well," said Rory. He hesitated, then picked up the stack of equipment again.
Thanks?
"Thank you, Centurion," Flavia replied. "You do my Legion great honor by accepting our gift."
"You're welcome," said Rory, clearly feeling a bit awkward. "Right, I should go."
He turned, but before he reached the exit of the tent, Flavia's voice turned him back.
Whatever became of your charge, Veronicus? Were the legends true? What was the Pandorica? And do you watch over it still?
Rory considered his answer for a moment, then smiled. All legends are true, he told her, for certain values of true. And, leaving that for her to think over, he left the tent. He'd just put the gear down on the camp bed he'd staked out in the corner of the government house lobby when Amy Pond arrived. She was rumpled and tired-looking, like him, and for that matter, pretty much everyone else he'd seen in the last hour or so, but also weirdly radiant, her green eyes bright, as she approached. For all that Amy was essentially a kind and loving woman, Rory reflected, she did dearly love a good scrap. Scottish. Hey, she said. Noticing the armor, she gave him a questioning look. I thought you were giving that stuff back when the fighting was over. I was, Rory said. They made me keep it. It seems my reputation precedes me. Among Romans, at least, he added wryly. Heh, that's usually my line, said Amy. Then, without further preamble, she took advantage of the absence of adult supervision by hugging and kissing him as if trying to dislodge his stuffing. Disengaging after 30 seconds or so, she grinned at his slightly disoriented face, thrilled as ever that she still had the power to do that to him after all this time, and said, "What do you say we find something to eat? I'm starving." 12:10 hours GST, Babylon 6. By the time noon rolled around on the station, Kaname was starting to get antsy. Misuki, Maya, and Shiori had gone back down to Gerardo to forward Kaname's messages and to get ready for their spring break. The news on TV, which had been the topic of choice through the entire morning, had shifted to a post-battle analysis mode, where more pundits and talking heads were discussing what had happened in excruciating detail. And there was the continued presence of Sosuke Sagara, seated and on guard at the corner next to her biobed. She had made a few attempts at small talk just to fill the time, but they never ended up the way she would have expected them to go, so after a while she just shelved the idea. Instead, she tried to catch up on some long-deferred sleep, now that it appeared that the cosmopolitical shitstorm had blown over for the moment. Unfortunately, her stomach had other ideas. "Oh, come on," Kaname muttered as she turned over on the biobed, while trying hard to ignore the growling of her stomach. Finally, with a disgusted sound, she sat up again and ran a hand through her hair as she looked around. "Wonder what one has to do to get some service around here." She looked on both sides of the biobed to try and find a call button, but when she looked over toward Sosuke, she saw that he was addressing his own lunch concerns. Kaname tilted her head, studying the small, thick, rectangular biscuit that he munched on like most people would an energy bar. "What's that?" Sosuke chewed, swallowed, and then nodded. "Calorie Mate. It provides a sufficient amount of nutrition to allow me to keep functioning during long periods." He reached inside his jacket to pull out a gold foil pouch. "I have some extra. Would you like some?" Kaname considered for a moment and then nodded. Sure. She accepted one of the bars, chewed, and tasted it. The biscuit had a consistency like dry shortbread and tasted faintly of maple. She swallowed. "Not bad. Better than rat bars, at least." Sosuke blinked. "You've eaten ration bars?" "Yeah, we went on a camping trip that went off the beam a few years back, and, well, I don't want to talk about it," Kaname muttered, looking to the side in embarrassment. "Oh, but I like that story, Kana-chan," a cheerful voice announced from the doorway. Kaname's head snapped around. "Kyoko? Tessa, what are you two doing here?" She looked at the two women entering with surprise, and then flinched as the blonde who'd spoken took a quick picture with a tiny camera.
Ack! Hey! No pictures!
I believe you could consider this an intervention, Kaname, said the second entrant with braided platinum hair, as she carried a cafeteria tray filled with food.
We brought lunch, said the first, gesturing towards the tray with her non-camera hand.
As the two women entered, Sosuke sized them up. They were both short and petite and could have been mistaken for young teens of Kaname's social circle, if it weren't for the fact that they were both wearing khaki Mars Division duty uniforms, the blonde with the bars of a senior lieutenant, the platinum-haired one those of a commander. Given these facts, Sosuke made note not to underestimate either of them, or their apparent ages. Finally blinking the spots from her eyes, Kaname relaxed and smiled, settling back on her pillows as the tray was attached to the portable table next to the biobed.
Spirit of light, you're just in time.
Kaname gestured to the two women, who nodded in turn. Sosuke, these are my aunts, Kyoko Tokiwa and Talitha Testarossa, but you can call her Tessa. Everybody does. They've been in Mars Division with Mom and Aunt Maya since forever.
All the way back since the bad old days.
Kyoko nodded, and came over to Sosuke's side of the bed, studying him behind her thin data glasses.
So you're the guy Kana-chan just won't stop talking about?
Not bad.
Sosuke blinked, while Kaname sputtered and went red.
Kyoko?
On the opposite side, Tessa regarded Sosuke speculatively, making a thoughtful sound. Kaname turned where she sat and gave Tessa her trademarked look, the one that had a tendency to freeze freshmen in their tracks with guilt. But Tessa just giggled and, with a smile, backed off. Kaname rolled her eyes.
Anyway, now that we've gotten that out of the way, how are you doing?
Not much to report at the moment, said Kyoko, removing the cover from what proved to be a plate of decent-smelling Chukaba Shyam.
Nothing concrete, anyway. Big upswing in Federation sub-ether traffic, mostly on the diplomatic freaks, but I'm not clear to intercept it. It might have to do with the Tau Ceti thing, but...
She shook her head.
I don't know. I don't like it.
Tessa nodded. What's weird is that Earth Force is on full alert, but they only did that 4 hours after Trident hit Tau Ceti, and there's no sign that they're preparing to reinforce the 10th. In fact, it looks like they're falling back to the core of the Alliance, Earth and the Rigel colonies. Kaname eyed her.
I'll have to take your word for it that that's weird, she said, forking up some lunch.
Weirder still is what Starfleet's doing, Kyoko said, or rather not doing. They pulled their observers out of Tau Ceti at the same time Earth Force went to DEFCON 2 and...
Kaname flopped down on her back, eyes glazing.
Going back into coma.
Sorry, said Kyoko. Hey, you asked.
I asked how you were, Kaname said, sitting back up. Not for a galactic sit-rep.
She shook her head with resignation and went back to eating her shyam.
Military people, she grumbled, closing one eye and glancing at Sosuke with the other.
Honestly.
Oh, well, I'm fine, and Tessa is...
Kyoko glanced at her colleague, who was looking at Sosuke with that speculative half-smile again.
Obviously plotting to steal your new G.I. Joe doll. But you must be used to that kind of thing by now, right?
Kaname pointed imperiously at the door, but was unable to keep a smile entirely off her own face.
Out. Out, out, out. Thank you for lunch. Wonderful to see you. We must do it again sometime.
You were right, Tessa. She's being completely ungrateful, said Kyoko airily as she got up to leave.
Tessa nodded.
It's probably the start of a rebellious phase.
Yeah, Kyoko agreed. Next stop, tattoos and weird piercings. Maybe we need to revive the Jump Street plan after all.
Kaname sighed.
You're killing me here, she said mock plaintively.
If you think we're being bad, Kyoko told her, wait until Mao and Weber get here with your change of clothes.
You know, Kaname said conversationally, I didn't have a headache when all I had to deal with was neurological trauma.
Then she dropped the pose. She and Kyoko giggled together, heightening the latter's resemblance to a teenager.
We've got to get going anyway, said Kyoko. Got to get back to the ship and see if we can get a handle on what's going on. Tessa, when's your debriefing with the chief?
1700, Tessa replied. Hopefully by then we'll have a clearer idea of what's happening.
Thanks for coming, you guys, said Kaname. Even if you are troublemakers, she added with a smile as they left.
When they'd gone, she turned to Sosuke and said,
Funny, I was expecting you to chip in.
Sosuke shook his head.
Negative. They brought up several points that I had yet to learn. I'll have to consider how they fit into the larger picture before I have anything meaningful to say about it. Besides, he added with a completely straight face, I knew that the topic wouldn't be conducive to your digestion.
Kaname snorted.
Never stopped you before, she muttered, returning to her lunch.
She didn't speak again until she'd finished eating, at which point she recovered the tray, pushed it aside, and said,
So, what did you think of Aunt Tessa?
Sosuke appeared to think the question over for several seconds.
Well, she is quite charming.
Kaname looked blankly at Sosuke.
What?
Sosuke gave Kaname a blank look.
I'm not a droid, Miss Chittery.
Orifice. Anakin awoke for the second time in however long with the distinct impression that his head was capsizing. This time, though, when he pried his eyes open, the first thing he saw was not the dark timbered ceiling of Soji Mikage's study, but rather Lena Tarrant's face.
Hey, she said.
Hey, he replied.
What a day, right? Said Lena.
Then, turning, she called, Professor, he's awake.
Ah, good, said Mikage, who appeared in Anakin's field of view a moment later, leaning over him on Lena's left.
You should be able to get up safely now, the wizard told him. Anakin sat slowly up, rubbing his left hand down his face. As he did so, he felt an unexpected sensation at the end of his right arm. The pain was gone, there as, he was pleased to notice, everywhere else, but in its place there was a strangeness. It took a few moments' concentration to pull the experience together into a context where his mind could make any sense of it. But when it finally did resolve, what it resolved into was a hand. Blinking in surprise, he raised the arm, noticing the unusual weight of it as he did so, and found himself confronted with not a mechanical replacement like the one he'd destroyed, nor, his second most likely scenario under the circumstances, some sorcerous regeneration of the flesh-and-blood limb he'd lost years before. Instead, he found an object that appeared to have been sawn off a statue, if there existed anywhere a statue depicting a 10-foot-tall man wearing segmented plate armor.
What the... he muttered.
He flexed the fingers of the strange replacement. The faint scraping sound it made, and the extremely peculiar sensation its movement produced, confirmed what his eyes were telling him, as did a tentative touch with the fingertips of his left hand, which he was faintly startled to feel from both sides, as it were. The surface was smooth, though not polished, and faintly warm to the touch.
It's made of stone, he said, incredulous.
He looked up at Mikage's curiously delighted-looking face.
Yes, it is, Mikage said.
He bent and peered at the transition between Anakin's flesh and the stone just above the elbow. Anakin looked more closely as well. The join appeared seamless in spite of the wild disparity of the two materials. After turning the arm over in his hands and examining the connection through a jeweler's loop,
The wizard straightened up and clapped Anakin on the shoulder. "The graft appears to be a complete success," he declared. "It will be most interesting to observe the effects." Anakin got to his feet, gazing thoughtfully down at his slightly disproportionate new forearm and hand. Then, moving with a sudden speed that startled both Mikage and Lena, he seized the wizard by the front of his robes with the stone hand and lifted him clean off the floor. "What did you do to me?" he demanded. "I repaired you," Mikage replied, seeming unconcerned at his predicament, "and gave you a very valuable gift in the process, so you might at least consider showing some gratitude," he added a touch huffily. Anakin stared hard at his face for a moment, then let him slowly down and released him. "What is this?" he asked in a somewhat calmer voice, regarding the hand again. "That is the Hand of Wrath," Mikage replied. "One of a set of stone hands wrought, I believe, by the same artificers who made the Blazing Throne and the Seed of Destruction at the dawn of time. It is a thing of some infamy. Its name appears, in translation, of course, in the legends of cultures throughout the universe." "What does it do?" Anakin wondered. "I've no idea," Mikage replied cheerfully. "None at all. It's said to be indestructible, but beyond that the legends are rather vague. Some claim its wielder becomes invincible, though I doubt that's literally true, or it wouldn't have been lying around Trigon's palace in Muspelheim with no one attached to it. Others speak of plagues, fire, slaughter of innocents, the bloody scourge, all the usual things," he said dismissively. Seating himself at his desk, he opened a large book, bent his head over it, and went on without looking up. "We'll just have to see what you discover. Off you go now. I have work to do. Let me know if it does anything unusual." Anakin looked from the hand to the wizard and back again a couple of times, then shook his head resignedly and left the office. "You're welcome," said Mikage pointedly just before the door closed. He kept reading for a moment longer, then looked up to see Lena gazing at him, a puzzled expression on her face. "Well, what are you standing there gawping at me for?" he asked. "Go with him. Unless I miss my guess, he's about to do something interesting." Right, said Lena, and she hurried after Anakin. She caught up with him partway down the hall, where he'd paused by a window and was looking at his hand in the light. It was, Lena thought, oddly beautiful, not its shape, which was a bit clunky and utilitarian, but in the weird midnight blue luster of its matte surface, particularly in the bloody glow of Orifice's perpetual twilight. Anakin heard her approach, glanced up, then looked at the hand again. "Hand of Wrath, huh?" he mused. Then he set off again, his long strides making Lena trot to keep up. "Where are you going?" she wondered. "First, my room," Anakin said. "And then?" He smiled a little cruelly. "Test drive," he said. 1527 hours GST, 2:27 p.m. Tau City time. Operation Trident, mission elapsed time, 1317. Tau City 4. Anthy Tenjo woke from a nap in the presidential bedroom off the Government House Situation Room to find Utina seated at the little desk near the bed, regarding the screen of a datapad. A half-dozen others were scattered on the desk in front of her. From where she sat propped up in bed, Anthy had her in profile, her one visible eye lowered, lips curved down in a glum frown. After a moment, she noticed herself being watched, turned, and mustered a slightly wan smile. "Sleep well?" she asked. "Rather," Anthy replied, rising. "Not that I did anything in this particular adventure," she added wryly, "but I do seem to be sleeping a lot lately."
How'd that happen? Utrinim mused.
I wonder, said Anthe, giving her husband a kiss on the way past her to the fresher in the corner. When she emerged, Utrinim hadn't moved except to put down one of the data pads and pick up another, which she was regarding with, if anything, an even graver expression.
What's wrong? Anthe asked.
Silently, Utrinim handed her the pad. Anthe scanned it quickly, her eyes going wide. It was the casualty list from the Valiant's part in the space battle before they had landed. She had known a few members of the vessel's ad hoc shipyard crew were killed, the first time such a thing had happened aboard the Valiant. Now she knew who they were. Most of the names she didn't recognize, but one jumped out at her as familiar. Evans, William G., PO2.
Oh, said Anthe quietly.
She handed the pad back and put her hand on Utrinim's shoulder. She remembered Will Evans, a cheerful, very polite young man from the Crown Colonies. He had been an engineering staffer on one of the ships that had taken part in operations with Challenger the previous fall, when Utrinim had temporary command of the flagship and the fleet. He had dined at the Commodore's table once, selected more or less at random, and made an excellent impression. Anthe remembered Utrinim remarking that he had a bright future ahead of him in the Space Force. And now he was dead.
I'll have to write to his mother, said Utrinim, not really looking at her or anything else.
I'll have to write to all their mothers. She sighed, long and slow.
Or fathers, or husbands, or wives, or whoever. Whoever will miss them the most. Personnel will know.
She raised her hand and patted Anthea's where it lay on her shoulder. Suddenly returning from wherever she'd been, she looked up and met Anthea's eyes, her own solemn and intense.
Promise me you'll never let me take that lightly, she said. That you'll make sure I always, always count the cost.
She closed her eyes, a tear slipping down one cheek.
No matter how hard it is.
Anthe lowered herself carefully to her knees next to Utrinim's chair, leaned in, and kissed away the tear, reminding Utrinim with quite sudden and startling intensity of her brother, the good one.
I hardly think you'll need me to make certain of that, Anthe said softly. But I will.
Thank you, Utrinim said, almost inaudibly. They held that tableau for a few seconds, then Utrinim pulled herself together with a visible effort, sighed again, and picked up another datapad.
Back to work, she said with a weak attempt at jauntiness.
Anthe rose and kissed her again, on top of the head this time.
I'm going for a walk, she said.
Be careful, Utrinim said automatically. Anthe didn't laugh, though under the circumstances it had been a rather silly thing to say. She just said that she would, and that she loved Utrinim, and left the room. Hours GST, Babylon 6. At long last, Julian Bashir had admitted that there was nothing more he could do or observe in the strange case of Kaname Sterling. She'd just finished dressing, in regular street clothes her recovery party had retrieved from somewhere, and was standing by her bed, packing the few things she'd brought with her in a Mars Division kit bag. Mars Division's Kurtz Weber and Melissa Mao loitered by the door, waiting for her to finish up so they could accompany her back to Gerardo. Probably not necessary, but you didn't argue with Miranda when she was in this kind of mood. In the corner, the TV was still playing quietly, various highlights of the footage from the Tau Ceti incident repeating between the ongoing, and not very interesting, commentary and analysis back in the studio.
There, she said, looking around. Am I forgetting anything?
Not that I had much stuff to forget. She looked into the open bag. Old Jindai uniform, dressy shoes. She patted the pockets of the light jacket she now wore. Keys, ID, cell phone, discharge paperwork. She glanced at the corner of the room, where Sosuke, naturally, still sat. Mercenary. Nope, that's the lot. Kurtz grinned. Then let's get out of here and get you back to some fresh air. Mao looked about to agree, then perked up a little as she caught something one of the people on the TV were saying. Turning, she thumbed the volume up key. The scene in the Tau City Government Center emergency bunker just a short while ago.
Wait, she cried. We can't go yet. Konami, you gotta see this.
The screen changed to the slightly grainy signal of a field cam drone, previously recorded at the scene, flashing in the lower right corner. The scene was a smallish, utilitarian room with ferrocrete walls and a number of computer consoles scattered around the walls between giant holographic maps of an urban area. At one side was a small group of armored Earth Force Marines, drawn together in a tight defensive knot around a couple of officers. At the other end, a somewhat larger group of Seleucian ODSTs and people who appeared to be high-tech Roman legionaries had plainly just stormed the room through the mangled remains of the blast door behind them. In the lead, the unmistakable, tall, pink-haired, slightly scuffed and rumpled figure of Utena Tenjo, flanked by that woman in the red-striped black armor and the equally unmistakable, towering shape of Master Chief Spartan. Colonel Plummer, said Utena, her voice sharp and rendered slightly tinny by the recording. Your forces are surrounded and your defenses destroyed. Your operation has failed. In the name of the International Police, I require your immediate surrender. Watching the replay, Mao nearly wriggled with delight, whispering, "Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it." Konami duly waited for it, as did Kurtz, though he'd seen it many times before. In the corner, unnoticed, Sosuke was the only person in the room paying no attention to the screen. He was focused instead on the display of his mobile comm. The leading Earth Force officer, red-faced under the brow of his helmet, gritted his teeth. "It'll be a cold day in hell before my Marines surrender to a child," he barked. Apparently unconcerned about the 24 or so rifles Utena's people had pointed at him, he reached to his belt and drew a combat knife. Then, advancing a step, he snarled, "Let's see what you've got, little girl." "And," said Mao. With a speed and fluidity that didn't seem possible in a man of his armored bulk, the Master Chief darted forward and, before Plummer even had a chance to react, clobbered the Earth Force officer on the side of the head with the butt of his rifle, sending him sprawling full length on the floor. "Bam!" Mao cried, miming the same move. Without appearing to miss more than one beat, Utena turned to the other Earth Force officer and said, "Let's try that again. Lieutenant Colonel Coppola, your forces..." "I know," Coppola replied. Then addressing her own troops in a leaden voice, she went on, "Stand down, boys and girls. It's over." "And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how you do that," said Ma with a tone of immense satisfaction. "Man, I could watch that all day." "And you pretty much have," said Kurtz dryly. "The miracle of modern media," Konami said. "Seriously, that is the best thing ever," Mao insisted. "I want that clip to play as the startup screen on my workstation." "It's pretty good," Konami admitted. "Can we go now?" Sure, grab your gear and let's head out." Raising her voice slightly, Mao addressed Sosuke. "You ready to go there, cowboy?" Sosuke returned his mobile comm to his top pocket and rose from his seat, nodding. "Affirmative,"